All right. Let's get fired up here.
Maximum freedom. Read.
Stay on target.
Maximum freedom.
Stay on target.
Maximum freedom. Read Rothbard.
Well, hello and welcome to the Actual Anarchy Podcast, the podcast where we talk about movies from a Rothbardian anarcho-capitalist perspective. Tonight, it's episode 250 of the show, and it feels like a milestone of sorts, and so we have a really big guest coming up in just a few moments. We're going to be talking about Oliver Stone's film from 1986, starring the great James Woods, Salvador, and we're going to have plenty and plenty and plenty of stuff to talk about on this one, but I want to check in with Robert, see how you're doing. I know that you've had a recent bout of pain. I think if you were on the rack in Princess Bride, they would say that they've just sucked 1 year out of your life for the past 36 hours. And I think that we might discuss some of this as a torture tactic that someone might learn in the School of the Americas during this discussion here. But how are you doing now? You're upright. You're able to enunciate words, and you are here. So that is a big improvement over what I was expecting based on our last correspondence over the past couple of days.
Yeah. So I was pregnant. I'm not going to tell you who the impregnator is, but I'm the proud father of a 1/10 of an ounce baby boy who has caused me nothing but intense, excruciating, mind-numbing pain. And I was happy to get the birthing process over with, and then we can get on with our lives. I'm happy to, looking forward to see him grow up and, you know, do all the things that the babies do. Take them to the park, you know, push them on the slide and throw them around with the baseballs. That's what you do with the kids, right? Looking forward to it.
So if it's a boy, is it Bam Bam? And if it's a girl, is it Pebbles? Is that what you pick a name yet?
Yeah, I was thinking Spike or Iron Maiden or, I don't know, Painbringer. Just something appropriate, but I like your Pebbles and Bam Bam. That's good too.
Okay. I mean, we did do Croods last week, so, you know, it sort of ties in. And
it was a surprise pregnancy. I was taken a little bit back. I was not expecting it. Let me tell you that. It was one of those oopsies, you know.
Mm-hmm. Those oopsies. You're just lucky you didn't do it in Texas.
What's the reference there? I don't get that.
Oh, well, you've been in so much pain, you haven't seen all the outrage on the social media platforms for the Supreme Court's decision not to overrule Texas in banning like some level of abortions there.
No, that's news to me.
Okay, yeah, they're screeching pretty hard about it.
No, I carried mine to term and gave birth, and he's a happy and healthy little boy. And he's not going to be vaccinated. I don't know, people are going to freak out about that, but you know, keep him all natural. And you know, he's sleeping right now. He's doing good, but we're looking forward to. I tucked him in for the night. He's sleeping soundly. Hasn't cried once yet, which has been, I've cried way more than he has. So that's, that's a surprise.
Okay. That's good. Well, I only hope that, you have some of the pain medication still in you. So you're a bit loopy and a little bit loose and, really speak your mind on this one. Cause this one is a hot, hot movie. And we've got a hot, hot guest coming up right after these messages from ourselves. Hey everyone, it's Daniel Elwood, and Robert Paul Johnson is my co-host, and we are the Last Nighters. You can find us at lastnighters.com, and this is episode 193 of the show. You can find the show notes more at lastnighters.com/193. You can also find us on the Liberty Movement's YouTube channel. We're talking about Oliver Stone's 1986 semi-masterpiece, Salvador, starring James Woods, and we have the great Free Man Beyond the Wall podcaster, and he's not just one of the top podcasters in our sphere. He's one of the top podcasters in the world. I mean, if you look at his numbers, he's in the top 5% or top 1%. It's something amazing. And he's been a multi-time guest with us, usually for Kevin Costner flicks, except one occasion we did Casablanca, which he had to do. It's a great movie. He got the perfect 10 for the first time ever on our show. And this one is actually sort of a Kevin Costner adjacent film, because we did do JFK with you last year, which was directed by Oliver Stone. And then this was also directed by Oliver Stone. So we're going to do the Kevin Bacon 7 Degrees of Separation to bring this movie into the orbit of the great Pete Quinones of the Free Man Beyond the Ball podcast. Pete, why don't you remind people where they can find your show and what do you do on your show?
Free Man Beyond the Wall podcast. I pretty much interview anyone I want. And a lot of those people end up to get some people mad. Some of the conversations. I have a Substack. By any memes necessary, pquinones.substack.com. And our production company, Stateless Productions, is currently doing the interviews and shooting for our second documentary, which will be on America's police crisis. And our first documentary is on Amazon Prime, called The Monopoly on Violence, which is the first feature-length documentary explaining to the world what anarcho-capitalism is.
Right. And that is really well done. I'm very proud to know you and that you
have you reviewed that on this show yet?
You know what? We haven't. I've seen it just on a personal level and really enjoyed it, but we could review it on here because
nudge.
It is a movie and it's a good one. So we should definitely do it. And you know what? I think I know a good guest for it.
Probably. Yeah. He probably knows a couple things about it.
Yeah. Well, anyway, thanks again for joining us. We always enjoy having you on. I know it's not a Kevin Costner flick. He did recently do a Field of Dreams, like Celebrity Game.
Yeah, I saw that.
So that could have been like, you know, we could have worked it in. But I think this one is a little bit more prescient and a little bit more like, I think you wanted to talk about this because you see some similarities perhaps in what's going on in present time. At least that's what I thought when I watched this movie. It is gritty and gripping. And James Woods, of course, is great. He has a fire Twitter account, much like yourself, by the way. He's pretty badass. I just really enjoyed this film. And so I'm glad that you brought it up. And I would not have known to watch this movie had you not recommended it.
I'm glad. It's one of my favorites. It was, when it came out, I was all over it. I thought it was just fantastic. And like I told you before we started recording, I've seen it. I watched it back then many times. I just watched it over and over again. I was just enthralled by it. It was
on the old VHS hitter. Rewind it.
Oh, yeah.
Uphill both ways. Yeah.
Make sure somebody didn't tape over it. Yeah.
Oh, right. Yeah. That used to be a thing. Yeah. So anyway, we can kick this off. I usually have the Google description pulled up, which I got to get this going here. Oh, and by the way, that pre-show bonus content that we were talking about that you just mentioned is available for our Patreon supporters. People can find that at patreon.com or lastnighter.com/patreon. Yeah, that's the right one. Okay, so here we go. Is it showing up for you guys right now? No, it's not. Not yet. Hold on. I got to hit one more button and this amazing content right here. There we go. Okay. So here we are with Salvador,
And Daniel killed himself. What happened?
Bye, Daniel.
See ya.
So mid-sentence. James Woods does have a pretty good Twitter account, but he put out one of the dumbest tweets I've seen in so long recently. He said, "So when does the Taliban come marching across the unprotected Mexican border?"
I guess it helps if you press the right button.
What? Yeah. Boomer moment.
I know, right? So we'll take it from the top. I'll cut this little section out, unless you guys were like roasting me hard, then I'll leave it in. I don't care.
I was roasting James.
Classic Daniel, man. We talk about gotta leave that in.
Yeah, I gotta fuck it up, man. All right. So now if I hit the right button and this button. Okay. All right, much better. Okay, so how we usually start this off is with the Google description. So here we go. Salvador came out in 1986, drama/war film, 2 hours and 2 minutes, and Oliver Stone joint rated R. 84% of Google users like it, 7.4 out of 10 on the IMDb, 89% Rotten Tomatoes, 3.9 out of 5 on Voodoo, and apparently I'm just learning this now. This is available on Hulu, which I do have a Hulu subscription. However, I did not know that at the time, so I actually paid Amazon some rental fees to be able to watch this. I don't feel too bad about it because it was a good movie. So here is the description. Unable to find work in America because of his penchant for booze and drugs, photojournalist Richard Boyle, played by James Woods, heads to El Salvador with his DJ friend, Dr. Rock, played by James Belushi, to see if he can get a gig covering the country's ongoing civil war. Boyle decides it's time to flee the country when the violence escalates to a level that even he is uncomfortable with, but his relationship with an El Salvadorian woman, played by Elpidia Carrillo, complicates matters. Release date, March 5. 1986, director Oliver Stone, box office of $1.5 million on a budget of, I believe, about $5 million that Oliver Stone put a second mortgage on his house to be able to finance before he got another producer on board. He put his own skin in the game and came out with a pretty decent flick. Now, Robert, I'm going to go to you for your opening salvo, but I'm also going to ask you, do you think that they learned effective torture methods at the School of Americas, such as implanting kidney stones in order to torture their victims? And only to cure them by waterboarding them with Coca-Cola Classic as the only known cure.
Robert, that is an overly elaborate torture method. I don't know if the CIA would just be hanging around implanting different things into people's bodies with the hope that they form kidney stones. But it is an intense pain, as Senor Quinones and I can attest to. I think, Daniel, you are kidney stone free for your life, and I hope you remain that way for the rest of your life. It is not a pain I wish on anyone else. The movie, though, is it's pretty intense. This is a fairly I'm usually not a fan of war films. I like the spectacle of them, but I'm not generally a fan of the story or the protagonists in those stories, because they're usually fairly limp protagonists. They kind of go and do stuff and things happen. And there's a lot of that. This movie really shows the chaos of war, even though he's not a soldier. He's a journalist covering the wars. And he is a broken character, and it's no shock that he goes to broken places that are just as broken as he is, and he can just kind of thrive in this chaos. Not only does he enjoy just the misery, I don't know, he's trying to find happiness in this miserable place, but he's actually a protagonist that actually does want things, and he does try and get them. He doesn't have the best arc per se. He's a broken character at the beginning, and he's pretty much still a broken character at the end. But he does have this woman that he falls in love with that he does want to be better for. So I was rooting for him. There's this kind of competition he has with this proto CNN type mouthpiece lady, where she's asking the absolutely ridiculous questions of these politicians that nobody gives a shit about. And then he's the one that's like, You're bullshit. You're bullshit. Just stop asking bullshit questions and ask him something real. And so you're like, okay, this guy actually cares about the truth. He cares what's happening to the people. I mean, because he recognizes, you know, he actually has some humanity left in him. But there's so much to get into in this film, from the CIA involvement, the School of Americas, and how these people come down to these third world countries and tear them apart. How the CIA was backing the nationalist guy against the somewhat perhaps communist rebels, or were they not? It wasn't really clear in the film exactly. When they were showing the actual rebel camps, I didn't see a whole lot of communist ideology in there. They just seemed to be people that wanted change and were worth, you know, violently getting it after it. But anyway, I'm curious to hear you guys' thoughts. It's definitely a lot of stuff going on in this one, so let's get into it.
All right, yeah, very good, Robert. And I think that there was a little bit of, you know, red flags and fists and some speaking to communism. I think that Oliver Stone is kind of left-leaning, or at least left sympathetic when it comes to that kind of thing. Now, I don't know how much of it is, were they legitimately communists or not? And Pete, maybe you know a little bit more about it, but I can imagine that the American foreign policy at the time was, well, these rebels are communists and we're against communists, so we're going to support the non-communists, but basically just create these death squads kind of happening. Sort of like the what some people view the Chilean model to have been with Pinochet and Allende. I don't know how much of that kind of relates to this as well, but I'm sure it's another topic of discussion. But from my understanding, the United States has been meddling in the entire Central and South American continent for decades and decades. A lot of it has to do with
200 years. It's literally 200 years.
More than that. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's certainly a lot going on in this, it is in the lead up of this. But my take on it by the end of it was everyone is the villain, really. They're all doing horrendous shit. James Woods' character even points out to the rebels that when they're executing their prisoners, they're like, you're no better than them. So I thought that that was pretty prescient because I'm sure they had high-minded ideals in their motivating the rebellion. And then here they are stooping to the level of what they claim is the, you know, thing oppressing them. And I think that that is expected, but also, you know, a little bit ironic, don't you think?
Thing I like about the picture is that it just paints Central America in the 70s and the late 70s going into the 80s the way that it's been portrayed everywhere else. And yeah, Stone is more, he's more than left sympathetic. I mean, he's left, and he's, I would say he's communist sympathetic. I think I would not be surprised if the words, you know, real socialism has never been tried, as, or real communism has never been tried, has come out of his mouth before. And the thing I like about this picture is it just, it's a broken guy, a flawed character who is just out of choices. He's got nothing in life. And he's just like, well, let me go do what I know. You know, he talks about how he was in Cambodia and he was the last journalist out. And apparently he likes going to like the worst places. And, you know, El Salvador at the time was one of the worst places on the planet. You just had, you know, you had juntas, you had the killing fields of their own. And I don't think, looking back on it, there were really any good guys at all. I think you had, you know, right-wing fascism going up against left-wing communism. I don't know that it was full-on communist. I don't know how hardcore it was, but, you know, from reading Chomsky and talking to Chomsky's daughter about what went on in Central America at that time. Yeah, it was just one of the worst places a journalist would want to go. And especially a journalist like him, who's not hanging out at the hotel and interviewing people, but somebody who's actually going out into the field and doing things. And I think this picture just really paints a portrait of a time when the United States was in a Cold War with the Soviet Union, and anything that looked like communism, they would finance the worst of the worst in order
just
to
anyone who would be against it, an impediment to it. Yeah.
Yeah. That's pretty much the way it went.
Now, how does this, well, before I get to that question, you mentioned Chomsky, and Chomsky, similar to Stone, is good literally on like one thing. And that is his anti-war stance. I saw him recently advocating for mandatory jabs, I believe.
Yeah,
which seems to run very, very counter to his anarchist credentials and anti-war stance, because he's basically advocating for domestic war. But Stone, similarly, fairly anti-war. As you were mentioning, he's fairly left. He's also pretty good on privacy. I know he did the Snowden film and was supportive of that. I wanted to bring up the Sandinistas and the Iran-Contra scandal, because that was right around this period of time or shortly thereafter. That was running guns to Nicaragua, right? To finance dealings in Iran or something along those lines, right?
Man, there was so much going on. There were so many things going in different directions. So cocaine was coming up out of Central America, coming into America, being sold, that money was going to pay for weapons that were sent back to Central America. A bunch of that money also later on in the decade was making it, or earlier in the decade, not so far. You know, I don't want to say the years because I know I'm going to get it wrong and someone will yell at me, but some of that money was making it to Israel too. And Israel was, it was basically paying off weapons to Israel, and Israel was giving weapons to Iran in the Iran-Iraq war that the United States had already given chemical weapons to Iraq for. So the United States was on basically arming both sides of that. I mean, it's that was a cluster.
That sounds pretty familiar with things happening with Al-Qaeda and ISIS and all that.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. This is, yeah, everybody's like, how could you have Pentagon troops back, Pentagon troops fighting CIA troops in Syria? And I'm like, look at the 80s. It was ridiculous.
Yeah, shit's been going on for a while. All right. All right. So I know Aldi North was big into that. And he was famously brought in for congressional hearings and whatnot. But I was very young when all that was going on. But as far as what we see Boyle come into, it really does seem like you've got sort of the grand chessboard at play here. And that is, you know, manipulating different factions within countries to get sympathetic governments in place to do the will and the bidding of the United States. And I would imagine getting natural resources secured or things in place for multinational corporations along those lines, which I think gives a lot of credence to the anti-imperialist rhetoric coming from the left. You know, they talk about the Coca-Colas of the world and the wars and the military propaganda or the military campaigns that even Smedley Butler brought up from the 1920s, right? He wrote mm-hmm. War is a Racket, excellent mm-hmm. book. It's a very short read, but he's basically saying, I'm not here for freedom or here to, you know, do anything positive in the world necessarily. I'm here at the behest of the Dole Pineapple Company or the Chiquita Banana Company or whatever it was at the time. So I'll, of course, post a link to that. I think there's a free link for mm-hmm. a PDF to that I'll put on there. But the other thing that they were doing, this is, I think, mostly related to Central and South America and all the interventions that we're having there, is the School of the Americas. Now, I know this is a big Alex Jones talking point, but Robert, I know that you know a bit about it. So why don't you give us just a rundown of your understanding of it and how it may play a role in what we see develop in this movie, Salvador?
Well, we saw a piece of that, right, in that, what was it? That movie about Nima, Arkansas. What was the name of that movie? American Made,
Tom Cruise.
Yeah. Tom Cruise. We saw a bit of the School of the Americas in that towards the end when they were basically training these young, intelligent guys from these countries. You know, they get invited out to America to learn how to train in all kinds of techniques, torture, weapons, you name it. Then they send them back to basically do whatever needs to be done. They're just mercenaries to destabilize, you know, rape, murder, pillage, do whatever you need. I'm sure they can be used in any number of ways, but yeah, they're basically the, you know, the lackeys of the CIA that, do their bidding and, you know, they do their job pretty well. I think Carlos the Jackal was a famous one. There's a, I forget, Allende, was that he one? I forget. There's a whole pack of them that I'm sure don't even know their names, but they're used all over the planet from what I understand. And I'm not sure if the School of the Americas still exists today. It may still, or it still exists in some form, or maybe
it's probably an NGO. Probably what NGOs do now.
Now, wasn't the School of Americas brought up in JFK as well, when they were in Louisiana hatching the plot, where we had David Ferry and Kevin Bacon's character talking about training, I think, for
it may be that old. Yeah, I'm not sure.
I don't know if they would have called it that at that time, but yeah, I remember what you're talking about. Yeah.
Okay, yeah, it's a little, it's in there somewhere, a little vague and fuzzy, but there's so much information being crammed at us all the time, but before we get back into what's going on in this movie in El Salvador, can we talk about Richard Boyle's situation in San Francisco just a little bit? Because he's down on his luck. I mean, he seems to be someone who has put out good work in the past, and he's sort of coasting on that reputation, but he's been burning bridges along the way due to his penchant for drugs and boozing and womanizing and all of those things. So he's kind of burned all those bridges and opportunities, but he still kind of has whatever that it factor is to be able to get that photograph or the story or whatever it takes in these high stress areas. but he is down on his luck and he can't pay for the rent on his small apartment in San Francisco. Now, back in the 80s, it was probably far more affordable on the scale, even accounting for inflation, because it's just astronomical now, even though there's literally human feces on the sidewalks these days next to the needle exchange and all of the oppressive COVID policies that are happening there. But he is not doing well, and he's got an Italian wife and a son there who leave him. And then he gets arrested by some lady who says he's got 50 some odd unpaid parking tickets, a bunch of speeding tickets. And then he says, well, no, it's a different Richard Boyle. That's not me. And gets booked in the slammer, only to then be busted out by Dr. Rock, Jim Belushi, who says his dog is in Dog Dachau, which turns out he was right. The dog was euthanized. But did either of you have any thoughts on where he was at that time? And that's what kind of motivated him to like go and seek out this adventure.
Well, this is a guy that is constantly trying to stay one step ahead of all the people that don't like him or that he owes money to, or that he has pissed off in one way or another. He is the kind of guy that maybe he has some good instincts, but he doesn't follow those good instincts very often. He's that friend of yours that's always bumming money off you. Like he borrows money from pretty much almost everybody he talks to in this film, and you never see him paying it back. So you know he's not ever paying it back. And people that are loaning him the money know they're not getting it back. They're just like, oh man, okay, here's $50. Leave me alone. He's not a guy that really engenders a lot of, I think, loyalty is the main thing. If he was my friend, I think I would keep him at arm's length. He's that kind of guy that just, I could see why his life is a disaster, because he is not a complete human being. He is broken. We don't get an idea of exactly why. We don't understand his childhood or anything like that, but we know that he went to Vietnam, Cambodia, all these broken disaster war zones from an early age. I mean, he's 40 in 1980 or 42 in 1980. So he's probably been at this for quite some time, at least, probably like 14, 15 years ever since he was a young man. So, he's a disaster, and I don't think he changes much throughout the film. He claims to be in love with the predator girl, which was fun to see her again. And I think this is the only other time I've ever seen her. I don't know what happened to that actress, but she was just in these two movies, as far as I know. But it was fun to see her again. He struck me as the same at the end as he was at the beginning, which is fine. He's an entertaining guy.
Yeah, you know, I wonder if what made him have that it factor was the fact that he was so broken and just kind of didn't give any fucks and had nothing left to lose, and so he was willing to put himself in those harmful situations to where he could capture those last moments of, you know, he was the last journalist out of wherever, and he got a certain photo for this and a certain story for that. And that was kind of one of the driving factors for him sort of getting by on that kind of ability to do that. But that was because of his almost nihilistic approach to his own life.
Yeah. He was definitely throwing himself. He struck me, him and that other guy, the John character, I think his name was, yeah. They struck me as like storm chasers that just throw themselves at whatever chaos they can find and throw themselves in the thick of it just for that, not only the experience and the rush and the exhilaration, but to get that shot, to get those crazy shots. And yeah, that the only people that can do that are ones with pretty much nothing left to lose.
Yeah. Like they got a death wish going on.
He was in his, I would say, early 30s when the whole Cambodia thing happened, which probably made him famous. And then he had a best-selling book and probably made money off of that, squandered it, was probably invited to all the parties for a short time. He appears to me to be like the rock star that was like the one hit wonder and was wined and dined, you know, had a great world tour. And then it all just fell apart after that. And now he's just trying to go anywhere he can to get that rush that he felt at that time. And he's trying to relive that, where, you know, he's going to go down there and, I'm going to go down to a war zone. And what was it? He was talking to somebody and he was talking to that John character. And that John character is like, there's nothing for you here. Why don't you go to, I can't remember what country he said. He's like, there's no nightlife there. Oh, yeah. Yeah, he's like, yeah, he's also looking for a party, and he's just, I saw him as somebody who was really just trying to recreate like the best time of his life. And yeah, it was questionable as to whether it was and everything. I actually remember this being up for an Oscar, and like he was, the real Richard Boyle was sitting next to Stone in the audience, and he was drunk as hell. And he was like, he was just completely out of his mind and everything like that in the audience and everything like that. So the guy was a lunatic. You know, I mean, I think he's still alive. But yeah, he was a lunatic. And, you know, I would assume at some point he was a great journalist and a great photojournalist. But, you know, I mean, alcohol does things to people. But more than anything, fame does things to a lot of people. And looks like it screwed him up. Yeah.
And seeing all that horror that he was in the thick of, that doesn't help.
It didn't seem to bother him, though, because, you know, what Daniel's backdrop. And everything, even when they were out there, it seemed like the smell bothered him more than the humanity, than the lack of humanity.
Right. Yeah. That's an element I wanted to talk about, because it seemed as if the people living there were almost indifferent to it. Like they were aware of it happening, but they didn't seem to really be in fear of it. It seemed to be there was a lot of dehumanizing going on, where people were just kind of following orders, going through the motions, not really considering what was actually happening. And it feels like that is sort of repeating itself in present time, you know, and you always get in trouble for bringing up what happened in the 30s and 40s in Germany and comparing it to what might be happening right now. But the parallels are eerie. And if history doesn't repeat it, it very much rhymes. And I think that that's kind of what we're seeing. And in this movie, this period of time, it's sort of a microcosm of that, because with all this death and destruction going on, these people are still kind of just living their lives for the most part, unless you're in the rebel camp where you're one of these death squad, you know, with the El Guapo colonel guy going around just killing students for not having their cedulas. I mean, papers, please, you know, it's 1930s all over again. And I think the old lady at the, she said it feels like 1932 all over again.
Yeah, there was... different groups. It definitely felt like there were different groups in the country, and everybody had a different kind of perspective and agenda. And I appreciated that about the film. It wasn't all just monolithic. Everybody was involved. There were some people that were just trying to go about their lives and kind of trying to ignore it. And then there were the people that were affected directly by the war and were horrified, and they were looking for their loved ones and whatever. And then there were those agencies that came in, like the Catholic nuns and those people, the aid organization people that were trying to help. And then you had, it's the news class is an interesting little bit. They seem like, on the one hand, they're trying to shine a light on this horror, but at the other time, they just seem like a bunch of parasites. Like they are just there to show as much horror as possible, or they are there to push an agenda, but they are just there to, I don't know. I don't know how I feel about it. It was very unsettling to, you generally think of, you want a news media that's there. It's going to show, you know, shine the light on whatever unjust things are happening in the world or things that you need to know about. But it just seemed like they were so self-interested. And this is true of all humans all the time, of course. So it's not anything revelatory, but you know, when you watch somebody do a broadcast, you're not necessarily thinking about all the stuff that's going on behind the scenes, like all the self-interest things, all the moves that they're making. But then you watch a movie like this, it's kind of exposing that, and you're like, oh yeah, these are just people. They're trying to get the best angle on this to further their career, and they want to show the crying child as much as they can because this is going to win them an Emmy or an Oscar or whatever. And it just leaves a bad taste in your mouth, I think.
Yeah, wasn't it revealed recently that Biden had spoken with the now deposed president of Afghanistan and was trying to come up with a way to PR spin it so that it didn't look as bad as it actually ended up being. And the blonde in this, giving those softball questions to the candidate for running for president, reminded me of how they kid glove treat Biden prior to this Afghanistan withdrawal, totally in contrast to how they handled Trump. Which I was not a fan of how they handled Trump. I mean, yeah, they were asking him hard questions, but it was around stupid shit. It was around, oh, that mean tweet, this mean tweet. They didn't ask him any substantive, you know, like actual violations of, you know, human rights abuses or war crimes that he was committing. No, it was all about, oh, you said this nasty thing about Rosie O'Donnell or some shit. It's really fucking bizarre, you know. And then with Joe Biden, you know, they softball question him. They give him the questions ahead of time. He has a list of who to call on and when. That seems to have changed a little bit since this Afghanistan stuff, where it does seem like they've turned on him. But I also wonder if that's more like something else is at play here, where they're moving him out of the way.
Right.
You know, what you really see with the press, I just interviewed an independent journalist named Ashley Rinsberg, and he wrote a book called The Gray Lady Winked, and it's all about the New York Times crimes. Basically 10 instances where they had an agenda. And once you understand what the New York Times has done, how they didn't even pay attention to what the Nazis were doing, they made excuses for Stalin. You know, you realize the New York Times is complicit in more bodies than Hitler, you know, and Stalin probably combined. I mean, even the, you know, Iraq War II. And what he told me was, he clearly said, and I was happy to hear this from somebody who was probably identified with the left more. He said, yeah, I mean, they just have an agenda. And I talked to another guy who, his name's Oren McIntyre, and he used to be a journalist. And he said that he has been in press conferences with politicians and actually watched the reporters bully the politician into their agenda, where they're like, the politician will actually on the podium change his mind on something, change his position on something, and he's being bullied. And, you know, that's what Curtis Yarvin, Mencius Moldbug, refers to as the cathedral, where mm-hmm. it's the academia and it's the press who are driving this, where they're the ones who are driving politics. And to hear that from, you know, people that are seem to be trustworthy. I mean, I don't know how many people I trust in the world. You know, just getting that kind of confirmation is mind-boggling because, yeah, I mean, there was that blonde reporter. I believe she may have been New York Times, New York Post, something. It was just a joke. It was what you would expect from, like, what a Washington Post reporter would have asked Biden during the election season, you know, in the run-up to the election, you know, something about, you know, oh, how are you feeling? Kind of stuff. It's just, the press is, yeah, and I asked Rinsberg too. Rinsberg has studied the press, and I said, has there ever been a time when the press has been objective? And he goes, no. There's no, right. There's no way we can, and he said, everyone's going to have a bias. He said, you know, your belief system is going to come out in a bias. He goes, but they've always had an agenda.
Yeah. And remember the main?
Yeah.
It goes all the way back. And was it Durante who wrote about the USSR mm-hmm. and how everything's great? I've seen the future and it works. And didn't he win like a Pulitzer for it? And it turned out to all be lies.
Yeah, he had basically covered up the famine in the Ukraine. In Ukraine, they killed anywhere, estimates 3 to 11 million. Most people settle on 7.
Right, and that's the Holodomor, right?
Yeah, the Holodomor, yeah.
Yeah, where Stalin stole all the grain out of Ukraine and everyone starved to death.
Well, yeah, because it was, and it basically what happened was, it was calculation. Communists can't calculate. There was a famine coming. They knew, they had predicted that a famine was coming, but because they had no calculation, they didn't have enough food for the people. So when the famine came and it's like, well, the Soviet people are, you know, the people in Russia are dying. It's like, well, we don't even really consider the Ukrainians to be Russian. So let's just go take their food and whatever happens to them happens to them. I mean, that's basically what happened was it was just, they didn't plan. And it was just like, oh, okay. Well, you know, it wasn't like, oh, these Ukrainians, they absolutely suck. We're just going to starve them to death. It was like, no, it was like, terrible, what you would expect from communism. They couldn't calculate, they had no pricing system, and they ran short, and a famine comes, and it's like, oh, well, we need food for our people, and, you know, we consider Ukrainians to be, you know, like
The unvaccinated.
Like, yeah, pretty much. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay. I didn't know much about it. I know that a movie came out the last couple of years called Mr. Jones, which I think goes over that a bit. And it's supposed to be a great film. And I do want to do it as an episode at some point. If you haven't seen it, do check it out. Let us know if it's one you'd be interested in doing.
Okay. My family, my family lost people. My mother's side of the family is Ukrainian. And when my grandmother came here, she was in Moscow. My great grandmother came here. She was in Moscow in 1917. And after the March Revolution, she came here. So.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Then that would probably be right up your alley. You'd have a perspective on it for sure. And it's interesting you bring up, that it was perhaps a set of circumstances that they thought they had control of that they actually didn't do the calculation problem that put them in that situation, but it was how they chose to then make those decisions that was really, the criminal act. I mean, certainly they shouldn't be trying to command and control the economy because it doesn't work. And I wonder if that's similar to what happened with Mao and the Great Leap Forward, where they also had mass starvations due to their inability to plan.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think some of that though was targeted, seems to be targeted. And, I'm doing research on China for an appearance that I'll be doing. That I won't be announcing until Monday, but I've been reading a lot about China, and it seems like a lot of people, including Ping, want to go back to that Cultural Revolution. And one of the things that they're saying is they're like, "We're going to concentrate on America. This will be a war, a cultural war against America." And I was talking to Scott Horton today, and he's like, they're going to focus it inwards. They're going to torture. They're going to punish their own people. They don't even have if you read David Stockman, they're worse off than us. And they became capitalists in 1994? They're into the 30 to $40 trillion worth of debt in 25 years. And biggest mortgage company, national mortgage company is their bonds are trading at 50%. They're about ready to freaking go down the tube. Yeah, China's not taking over the world anytime soon. I'm scared that there's going to be another freaking Mao moment there. They're going to institute some more 5-year plans.
Yeah, I feel like we're already at a cultural war here in the United States, and it really reminds me of. Have you seen the Yuri Bezmenov presentations from the 80s? Yeah. I mean, you watch that and you're like, holy shit! This guy's like Nostradamus. But it's pretty wild, the destabilization.
G. Edward Griffin from 68 and 69. Have you seen those videos?
Yeah.
You could watch those today and they'd still be relevant.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah, totally wild. And Robert, I know you and I have shared videos with each other of those ghost cities in China that were built over the course
of... this company ever... I'll look it up. They have an American name and that they were the one... They were this company that's looking to... just absolutely fall apart, they're calling it the Chinese Lehman Brothers. So they're going to if they fall apart, you're going to have a 2008 in China.
Yeah. Yeah.
That will affect us too.
Oh yeah. No. Yeah. From the videos I was sharing with Daniel, there's massive, obviously malinvestment in government, encouraging investment in these ghost cities where they just build up skyscraper after skyscraper
with the worst possible construction
with basically cardboard and glue and duct tape, and people buy them anticipating them to increase in value, and then I assume they try and sell them at some point, but this has got to be some huge bubble that's got to pop at some point, because it's just nobody lives there. They're just empty, and they're just using them as basically investment. Back in 2006, 2007, when everybody had two or three houses, just because they were just going up all the time.
It's because they print money out of control. Their second biggest real estate company is called the Evergrande Group, and just to give you an idea, their operating income is down $9.914 billion since 2020. Their net income is down $1.26 billion since 2020. And they're up $147,000 in total assets, but their total equity is down $54 billion this year. They're done. I mean, it's toast. It's just a matter of time. I mean, unless they get bailed out. And if they get bailed out, look at the amount of I forget what currency they use there, but they're going to have to print it. And I mean, I've been reading David Stockman a lot lately, and it's amazing that we got off on China talking about Salvador. But David Stockman saying it's not like they have a Janet Yellen there. They don't have a Janet Yellen. They don't have a Paul Volcker. They don't have like somebody who can come in and be like, okay, we need to drop interest rates. We need to raise interest rates. We need to do this. We need just to like put a Band-Aid on it. No, they don't have anyone like that. And they won't bring anyone in from the outside. So they have like no economists there of any. I mean, that's how this thing has gotten completely out of control. And it's just going to be, they're on a suicide course. And to worry about, that's why, like, when I hear shows that, like, they're, you know, Steve Bannon just being this China hawk, like, crazy, I'm like, dude, they're just falling apart. You know, I mean, you have to worry about an animal when it's dying, you know, that it might strike out at you and everything. But still, this is like, this isn't long term. This isn't, China's not taking over the world. They are so extended. It is ridiculous. I mean, when you start looking into it, Daniel Lacaille has some great articles on Mises.org. David Stockman's behind a paywall, but he has, if you run like a David Stockman, like his website, and you run a search for China, it's like 70 articles in there just talking about how China is just decimating themselves. I mean, monetarily. And you know, you remember how Trump talked about, oh, they're manipulating their currency. I mean, you have no idea. And everybody's like, well, we manipulate our currency too. No, not like this. They've done worse in 25 years. They've destroyed more in 25 years than the Federal Reserve has destroyed in 107 years, 108 years. And it's just, it's going to be, the fall is going to be something to see. And I think they're going to, when they do lash out like a wounded animal, it's going to be inwards. They're going to punish strong people. And I think that's going to be sad.
It kind of feels like what's happening here.
Oh, God. Yeah. It seems to be, it's a trend. You know, I mean, it's like, I've seen people like say, oh, January on Twitter, oh, January 6th was an insurrection. And like someone will comment and like tag the FBI.
Good God.
It's like, what the hell is going on in this country? And it's like horse dewormer.
Yeah.
I mean, you realize that meme that the left is using is only like 4 or 5 days old. They've only started calling it horse dewormer in like the last 4 or 5 days. And it's like blown up to the point where NPR is saying it. And it's pretty, this is unprecedented times. Let me tell you something. It's,
unfortunately, most people have a short memory, so they forget, and it works, you know, on the majority of the non-thinking population.
Sure. So, people run with it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, one angle I wanted to take, because you mentioned these numbers of the losses in billions of dollars for that company, and this sort of relates to how you can lie with media and with news stories and things like that. And one of those is with statistics and how you present them. So when you present, you know, they lost X billions of dollars or lost this much equity or operating revenue. Well, compared to what, you know, so like how much scale does that actually mean? I'm not like trying to call you out. I'm just trying to make the point that this is often how you can back something up with statistics that actually don't really mean anything. Like what if, you know, $5 billion in compared to the overall size of that company is like 2%, you know, it might not actually be meaningful, that kind of a thing. But I've seen this happen, especially with the pandemic and how these things are not only recorded, but also reported and then presented, where you can almost manipulate statistics into saying whatever you want, depending on whichever angle you choose to decide upon. And I really feel like they're doing this on purpose so that they have statistical cover for the lies that they're sort of promoting out there. And you see this happen all the time, probably in all 10 of those news stories that you were talking about with the reporter who was talking about the 10 things that the New York Times was guilty about. I'm sure that it relates to those types of tricks and manipulations, especially related to statistics. So just a point I wanted to throw out there.
Sure. Statistics are important. So Evergrande, just to give you an idea, their total equity right now is $350 billion. They're down $54 billion this year. Okay. So that's insane. I mean, that is, I mean, can you imagine if you owned a company and you lost that much? I mean, what would your investors think? And that, why do you think they're, see, to me, it's like, I don't even need to look at that. I just need to look at their bonds, which are supposed to be trading at 100%. And then maybe you get a 1 or 2% return when you cash it in, or trading at 50%. That is, for bonds, that is insane. I mean, it's just like, what? I'm scared of what's going to happen in China, because I mean, I don't think, I think it'll have, it'll be, a, there'll be some hurt here as far as imports go and things like that. But I mean, I think they're just going to lash out at their people like they've always done. I mean, that's the history of what they've done. Yeah.
One last thing I'll make related to this. When you mentioned billions, that almost sounds quaint these days, because I listened to Tom Woods' episode today where Brian McClanahan mentioned quadrillions. And I feel like we're in Austin Powers where he says, Dr. Evil, that kind of money doesn't even exist. But it seems to now.
Who knows how much is in circulation now? They say it's a certain amount, but who the hell knows?
Right. Yeah. All right. Well, let's bring this back to Salvador, sure. The movie. And we should probably actually start winding down, because we are close to an hour on this. But are there any other points, Robert, that you would you saw when watching this that you wanted to make sure we discussed tonight?
Well, I thought there were the two CIA boys that show up a couple times during the film. One, there's a very interesting conversation between one of the two CIA boys and Boyle, where they're at some government building and they're catered and all having a good time, but they actually get into it pretty well, where Boyle's trying to get some papers for his wife or his girl in exchange for, you know, shots of the rebels with their weapons and that kind of thing. And they're unimpressed, but then they get into it kind of like ideologically. And at one point, the CIA guys, I think when they're talking to the ambassador, actually, maybe it was when they're talking to Boyle, I forget, but they seem to be very much true believers. Like, they have drank the Kool-Aid that they are the good guys, that they, at one point they say any alternative, they've made mistakes. That's their quote. Hey, maybe we don't do a perfect job. Okay. We make some mistakes. All right. Mistakes are made. It's a chaotic situation.
We're accountable.
but anything that, any alternative to our intervention would be 10 times worse. Like, they are just the fantastic people that are saving the world from these people who just don't know how to, you know, govern themselves. So these people come down, really think that they are preventing even worse mass murder and slaughter by putting it. Now, if they're talking about preventing the next Stalin, I guess maybe you could have some sort of an argument there.
But they do mention Pol Pot in this, and maybe that's what they talk, you know, think about.
Right. But that's really using your Nostradamus hat, that you're going to predict the future, that, you know, this guy is going to be the worst thing ever, and anything you do, therefore, is justified in stopping him. So that just justifies all the violence and horrible things that you do. Look, hey, I'm trying to prevent the next Hitler here, guys. So you can't hold me accountable to all the nuns I had to murder. I mean, nuns got to get raped and murdered. What are you going to do? So it just seemed to me a very cold and callous and unfalsifiable claim that, hey, we can do everything and we're the good guys no matter what we try.
And it carte blanches them, because they can use it to justify anything.
Anything under the sun. Hey, it would have been worse if we weren't here. So we're basically Jesus.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. You see a lot of that these days, just in the, you know, relation to the pandemic. And I saw something interesting. The one of the inventors of the mRNA technology, Robert Malone, he talks about how in 1984 they introduced into the Federal Register the concept of the noble lie. This comes from Plato, I think, where it's okay to lie if it's for the greater good or a social good. And they did this in relation to the polio vaccine, where they said, okay, we need to suppress any information that might be negative or cause any hesitancy towards vaccines, so that we don't compromise the effectiveness of vaccines or whatever. And this is back in, you know, in the 80s, back when vaccines were more traditional. Well, they've been sort of utilizing that on steroids. And that's one of the reasons why we see all the suppression and the ability to sweep away any contradicting or counter narrative information on the social media platforms. And it's sort of utilizing this concept that they think they are the on high experts who can deem what is okay to tell the population, even though knowing it's a lie. And we've seen examples of this with Fauci talking about, you know, masks or no mask and flip-flopping all the time, or even in the same statement, he'll make contradictory statements even in the same sentence. And it's as if they think that it's totally justified because their intention is good, or at least they think it's good. And this also goes into the conceit of knowledge that they can't actually possess, yet they seem to think they do. End rant.
Good rant, Daniel. I liked it.
Very good.
All right. Well, Pete, do you have any last thoughts on the movie before we get into a final summary review? And I guess we can give it a rating out of, number of like money shots, because he gets that one like killer shot of the plane coming in, and that's what takes out John, the photographer.
Yeah, I think that plane was probably the most important thing, because they kept saying, oh, the United States military doesn't have anything to do with this. And, you know, just at the end, it gets exposed that, yeah, they're fighting on the side of the right. And yeah, it's just the story is old as time. I mean, I'm firmly one of these people that's on the right and everything, but not the right politically. You know, it's like, right. Yeah, I'm on the right of the culture. I'm not on the right of politics. The right in this country politically hasn't seen a real right since what, the 1930s, with the old right, what Murray Rothbard talked about, the old right with Taft and Garrett Garrett and people like that. So, yeah, I mean, I just like how it just exposes, hey, yeah, it was the Americans all along.
Yeah, and the rebels were actually doing very well until those two CIA guys got the ambassador to relent and release the hounds, if you will, of the military assets that the United States had given to the Salvadoran army. And that's where the tanks came from and the planes and all those things. Because prior to that, the rebels were doing quite well and seemed to have the upper hand. Granted, they were also not taking prisoners at that point and just shooting them, which Boyle, of course, said they were being the thing that they were fighting, which is all too common.
Yeah, let me talk just real quick about that. That was kind of surprising, because when Boyle went out to the camps, he put their numbers at around 4,000 soldiers, like effective fighting. Like a lot of the rebels were just like moms and grandmas and kids and just like families. But he estimated their number at like 4,000. He's like, these, you guys don't have a chance. But you put them, like they had actually had a cavalry charge, which was crazy at one point. Like they were like, I think they're called boleros, like maybe like cowboys basically charging with guns. And they overran the defensive positions of the nationalists until, of course, they were countered by the U.S. hardware. But yeah, you gotta hand it to the bold, quick, fast military action of a good old fashioned charge.
Well, yeah. And also, you mentioned grandmothers and moms and everything. How do you defeat that? I mean, that's resolve. Yeah, there were stories from Vietnam. I remember one, they were talking about how the helicopter pilot came back in and there were arrows in the side of the helicopter. And somebody is like, how do they think they're going to beat us with arrows? And like, I think it was probably a non-com, probably like a sergeant turned to him and said, how do you think we're going to beat people who are shooting arrows at helicopters?
Yeah. And then even in this film, Boyle says you cannot win this militarily. There is no military path to victory in this war, because you are fighting people who live here. You're fighting families that are resisting you and will fight you to the end.
Afghanistan.
It's exactly Afghanistan, Vietnam. It's an unwinnable war.
Yeah. It reminds me of those Second Amendment like memes where, you know, you need F-15s to defeat the U.S. Army. And it's like a guy in a rice paddy with an AK-47, you know, just grinning.
Yep.
It's resolve.
Yeah. It is. It's who wants it more. You're not going to want it more than these families who live here.
Yeah. If one side is there to get companies back home rich, and those people are there just fighting for their lives, I know who's going to win.
Yeah. And we talked about this, talking about Havana and Godfather 2, about the Cuban revolutionaries who were, you know, willing to die for their cause.
Yeah.
And just had great resolve. I mean, unfortunately for a terrible cause, but they were true believers in it. So anyhow, we should probably get into final summaries and reviews here. So Robert, why don't you lead us off on this little trek through the jungle of El Salvador?
Love to, Daniel. Thank you. So Salvador, a movie I had never heard of, was not aware of. I didn't even, in all the Oliver Stone films I'd ever seen, I guess I've just seen the famous ones.
You're welcome.
And, yeah. So thank you, Pete. Appreciate that. I'm not really sure why this one doesn't get a little more attention. It's quite a powerful film. It's not, doesn't have any like big major flaws that I could see. It doesn't necessarily have, I don't know, it doesn't have that big Hollywood moment in it, like where it's just ripping your heart out or your jaws on the floor, like some kind of Saving Private Ryan or you know, some kind of Spielberg film like that. But it's got a whole lot of gritty realism. And it's based, I guess it's based for the most part on real characters, or it's amalgamated, or it's based on his experiences in that conflict. So it very much feels real. I'm sure it feels very human. Like, I'm sure a lot of the details were fudged or whatever, but you could buy it. Like, even when, you know, they get out, even the movie's pretty much over, he's still gotta like ask for favors to just try and get out of the country and get his girl out of the country. And then they get stopped by Border Patrol and she gets sent home. And it Hollywood would have written a more happy ending if it wasn't, you know, if it wasn't real, or if it, you know what I mean? So, yeah, it's strong. I mean, I don't think it's a perfect film. I didn't like James Belushi's acting. I thought that was a little bit wooden, a little bit weird. His delivery was a little strange, but towards the end when he just plays like a drunk guy, maybe it's a little bit better. But you know, this is definitely worth a watch. I appreciate all, man, it's a complicated thing that the U.S. intervention is just a shit show. And you could just, without a world without governments, it would just be, I know people are terrified, statists are just terrified of this idea, but look at all the horrible things that they do. All these people lusting for power and the bodies piling up. I know it's not your bodies. It's not the bodies of your friends, but they are human bodies. And anyway, I know I'm preaching to the choir, but it's more films like this need to be seen by more people. So I'm going to give this one 8 perfect shots out of 10. Everybody should check it out if they haven't seen it.
All right. Very good, Robert. Yeah. 8 out of 10 is high, high praise. And, you know, one of the common arguments is, well, what if a warlord takes over? What do you think we have now? Anyway, Pete, let's go to you for your final summary review and a number of shots out of 10.
Yeah, I just think that the movie is enjoyable, even if you don't believe any of it. If you believe it's really loosely based on fact, I think that James Woods' acting was actually really good in this. James Woods back then was one of my favorite actors. He just nailed it all the time and pretty much everything he was in. James Belushi was kind of odd in this. I'm kind of expecting him to die like at any moment during the whole movie. I think it's just a perfect representation of like the horror of American interventionism in a country that is not very far from us, you know. And one thing you need to notice is, when it comes to countries like that, it wasn't covered it was too close to cover in the press because it would be too emotional for people if it was too close. You can report on Afghanistan and Iraq because people can't even find it on a map, but people can be like, wait a minute, isn't El Salvador just like 3 countries south of us? What, you know, what's going on there? And yeah, I just think that knowing that time, reading like Chomsky's Turning the Tide, and studying what they were doing down there at that time and what they have been doing in Central America for 200 years. It was impactful for me the first time I saw it. And watching it again, I thought it was, of course, it was dated because it was made in 1986, but because it was also a period piece for 7 years earlier, you could forgive some of what was going on as far as like the datedness of it. But I think it's something that everyone should see. If people like Oliver Stone, if people don't like Oliver Stone, I think it's a really good movie to watch. And I give it 7.5. What is it? Perfect shots? Is that what we're doing this time?
Yeah, I think he called it money shots or
perfect. I think it's perfect shots. I give it 7.5. I would go to 8. Go to 8.5 if I thought on the whole, a lot of the acting, even from some of the side characters, was just iffy. And you know, it's not a perfect movie, but you know, I think it's an enjoyable movie. I think that most libertarians and caps would enjoy it a lot. I mean, even if they don't, enjoy war movies, this is less of a war movie and more of like a political kind of intrigue movie. So.
Yeah. And I think Robert's kind of the case study for that. Cause not a big war movie fan, but I think you found this to be a good movie, right, Robert? You gave it a pretty high score.
Yeah, I did. I mean, usually war movies are just people going around and doing stuff amid all the chaos. And that's a lot of what this movie is, but James Woods, his acting was fantastic. He really plays this sleazeball really well. And he does have goals. He is an active protagonist of things he's trying to do, even if he is somebody who I really wouldn't want to know in real life.
Right. Okay. Well, here I go. I also found this to be a very gritty yet enjoyable film to watch. It was a little disjointed in some parts. Like it seemed like some of the scenes were just sort of jump cut, spliced together, and didn't really seem to flow very well together. Like all of a sudden he's looking all disheveled, and then the next moment he's looking cleaned up again. And so there's not a real sense of pacing or timing of when these things are happening. They're sort of just kind of jumbled together. And I wonder if that's just a matter of like, well, we have these certain scenes to shoot. And then in the edit, they started putting things together and move things around a little bit. But overall, you can definitely see Oliver Stone, just his fingerprints all over this thing. I really liked the score and the opening musical number or the opening, you know, drum hits with the machine gun fire. I thought that was very, very effective and very powerful. So overall, it's a really good film. I also have issues with James Belushi. I liked him in K-9. I thought that was probably his greatest work. Well, actually his greatest work is probably being John Belushi's brother. Cause John Belushi was hilarious. Rest in peace, John Belushi. But overall a really good movie and one that I had never even heard of. So thanks again to Pete for bringing this to our attention and having it be the episode tonight. I think it's a very, very fine film, and Oliver Stone does good work. He's a master. He's a pro. So that's my take. Did I give a score? Seven shots of the, I might switch mine from perfect shots to shots of whatever that cheap liquor was.
Yeah. So you're going to say that.
That's 17.
Tic-tac.
Yep. Whatever. 17 cents for a bottle. Tic-tac.
Right, you know what's funny? You know what's funny about that? The first time I ever went to Romania, which was not very long after communism fell, my favorite beer there was Orsis, and I was buying like 24-ounce cans for 17 cents.
Oh wow!
Wow!
That was a very drunken month.
All right. Well, very good. Well, Pete, thanks again for being our guest for this one. And people can find you at freemanbeyondthewall.com, also at the libertarianinstitute.org. You also have a Substack. We'll, of course, have links to all of that stuff on our show notes page at lasttimes.com.
Let me announce this. I don't know if you guys are on Twitter, but Scott Horton announced this today. A week from tonight at Thursday night's 8 o'clock Eastern time, from now on, biweekly, Scott Horton and I are going to be doing live streams. And we're going to be doing a live stream, and it's going to be called Libertarian Institute Presents the End of the Empire. And it will be us commenting on whatever the news of the day and just going off, and maybe I'll even get a word in edgewise.
Yeah. Yeah. He can run a mile a minute, man. I just listened to him on Dave Smith's show, and yeah, he's just so full of just information. His book is jam packed. I got the, Fool's Errand, and what's the most recent one?
Enough Already.
I got it signed because I donated some money, and he was offering signed books. Keith Knight actually told us about that, so that's the one. Excellent stuff. Everyone should read Scott Horton, listen to his stuff. And it sounds like do these live streams on Thursday nights at 5 p.m. Pacific. We're on, of course, the left coast. So 8 p.m. Eastern. That should be really cool. That'll be posted all up on Libertarian.
Oh, yeah, it'll go into the RSS feeds and everything. So
okay. Awesome. Well, thanks again. And I hope you can stick around for some of the Kathleen Turner Overdrive that we will do after we finish up here. But Robert, next week, we're going to be talking about the news and journalists yet again. I feel like we trashed them a little hard on this one, but you know what?
Deservedly so.
Well-deserved. They are the enemy of the people. And we're going to be doing the Disney romp Newsies with Abby Kleckner. And she reached out to us on our Facebook page. She was a student of Dr. Dennis Foster, who has been our guest for several episodes, most recently for Total Recall. He also did Logan's Run with us and a few others. And so she is a fan of our show, probably by way of, oh, I know him, I'll listen to it. And, oh, these guys aren't half bad. I know. People's opinions, right? They can do whatever they want. So that will be the show next week, Newsies. It's available on the old Disney Plus. So that will be what we do next week.
Okay. I don't know how hard-hitting a Disney movie about the news is going to be, but we'll see.
We will see. And maybe Mr. Jones at some point, Pete, after you watch it, let us know if it strikes you as one worth doing, and we can do that for the next one. It's not really Kevin Costner adjacent, but I think we can give it another pass, a la Casablanca or tonight's episode on Salvador.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, very good. Well, thank you guys for joining us for this episode. You can find the show and some more at lastnarrative.com/193. And if you want the pre-show and post-show bonus content, both show content is called Kathleen Turner Overdrive, which we're going to get into right after this. Go to lastnarrative.com/Patreon and do check out Free Man Beyond the Wall. Excellent, excellent podcast with an excellent guest. And we will see you guys all next week for the old Newsies. And I got to find the right button to play us out. And we'll say goodnight from last night, everyone. Peace out. All right, a few more.
Do I have a minute to go do something?
Certainly.
Like take a leak and yeah.
Yeah, I'll cut this part out.
All right, I'll be right back.
No, leave that part in. That's good. That's good.
Leave it in. Well, I got a few more minutes on the Actual Anarchy podcast. Our guest will be back in just a moment. And so I was going to pose a question, which I feel like I should wait till he's back because the question will be posed to him and I want him to know what the question is. But I could pose it to you, I guess, now, Robert. Recently in the news, El Salvador has been brought up again for being desirous of moving to the Bitcoin standard, if I recall. I haven't read too much into it, but people are kind of freaking out because they're moving away from, I guess, the US dollar as a thing backing their currency. I don't know much about it. Is this something that you're aware of? And what are your thoughts on what the implications of this might be, having a full-fledged country moving to a Bitcoin standard?
They're using it as like that would replace their national currency, or this would be something that would be backing a la gold or silver or something like that?
See, that question alone
is beyond your understanding.
Means you know more about it than I do.
Okay. Well, if they actually do move to make it more of a legitimate like state thing, then I mean, that's just one more adopter and many more adopters to the Bitcoin standard, which would only increase its desirability, increase its value. But, you know, one of the things keeping it from being like a really standard currency is just how volatile it is, right? Like people are constantly trading and it's, you know, going up and down, then there's not a lot of consumer confidence and maybe in it retaining its value, from what I understand, which is what keeps it from more people adopting it. In the same way that, you know, the Fed prints trillions of dollars and then it's inflation and your dollar loses its value.
And all of a sudden you're talking about quadrillions.
You're talking about quadrillions and then everybody's a millionaire and it doesn't mean anything.
Yeah, we're all going to be millionaires very soon.
I'm not a big monetary guy, but I know generally when I'm being robbed.
Yeah. And I think there's another issue, and I don't know if it's been solved by other kind of ancillary things, but the transaction cost and speed is pretty slow. And so I think there's a thing called Bitcoin Cash. Now, I don't know much about this, but I think it's intended to have faster, lower cost transactions that, or maybe Monero does this as well, where it's sort of like this sidecar thing where, and it also encrypts the information related to the transaction itself. So it pushes it through and it's still on the ledger, but it's not like as traceable as a Bitcoin transaction might be, because there is a lot of reporting that's sort of being demanded by the tax authorities. Also, speaking of reporting being demanded by the tax authorities, there's a bill being proposed right now that's going to require U.S. registered banks to report and record all transactions for every account greater than $600 in value. So the account itself has to have $600 or more, and then they'll be required to report all money coming in or going out to the IRS.
That's every credit card transaction, every credit card payment I make. Yeah. Every American Express payment I make.
So, I mean, and that's, wow. I think another thing that's going to push people away from the dollar standard. We were talking, Pete, while you were away.
I was listening the whole time.
Oh, great. Okay. Yes. You know, the El Salvador with the Bitcoin. Do you know much about it? I only know what I saw in El Salvador going to move to a Bitcoin standard, and then some people like screeching about it. But I don't know if it means they're going to use it to back their currency, or they're going to use it as their official currency for day-to-day transactions for the people in El Salvador.
Okay. So I talked to a Bitcoin guy and he said that they're looking to use it as currency. What he's worried about is, I mean, of course, anything that seems to want to legitimize it more, who are into cryptocurrency want. He's worried that El Salvador, the government, is going to tell people to use custodial wallets, and then they're going to steal their Bitcoin. He's like almost thinks it's going to be like a gigantic kind of theft thing.
Like
a trap where people are going to pour all their money. It's like, okay, you can use it, but you can only use this wallet, and it'll be a custodial wallet. And then they'll blame it on some hacker or something like that, which is impossible. I mean, anyone who knows anything about it, I mean, unless you're sitting there, unless someone gives you their keys, you're not going to get it. And they'll blame it. So that was his biggest worry, was that they were going to, you know, say, oh, well, you can only use this kind of wallet. And then they would just like take, you know, a million here, a million there, a million, and just start fleecing everybody. So,
okay. So standard government operation.
Well, yeah. I mean, El Salvador is on, El Salvador, just like Panama, is on the US dollar. So, I mean, if they're on the US dollar, you have to assume there's a lot of US control, down there, probably Federal Reserve banks, whatever. And that's what I would be most worried about. I mean, it'd be great to see, you know, and you know, what Carr is, Carr from Timeline Earth, formerly Friends Against Government podcast. And you know, he's like, you'll want to see a government do that, especially a government like El Salvador, because it's like, okay, well, I mean, this just might be a last ditch effort, because they've been so screwed for so long and everything, but we don't really know who's in charge of that. So
all right. Well, interesting stuff. And I guess I just brought that because it was a current kind of news cycle thing related to El Salvador. And of course, the movie is related to El Salvador as well. I guess that can wind up our Actual Anarchy episodes. People can find the show notes more at actualanarchy.com/250, the big 250. So a little bit of a fanfare and celebratoriness. And Pete, you've been on like six times now, seven times. You grace us with your presence. I'm humbled by that. I think that, the fact you make time for a little show like us, it means a lot to me. So I appreciate it.
I love talking about movies, and you guys are cool. So, so if I thought you guys were dicks, I wouldn't come on the show.
All right. I'll try harder. Damn it.
Yeah, really.
But a dick.
Really. If you try really hard, then I'm going to like you even more. So.
Oh yeah. Yeah. There's that. Okay. Yeah. You heard it here. Pete likes dick. No, just kidding.
Hey.
All right. You laid yourself into that one. All right. So we're going to get into some Caffeine Turnover Drive right after this, so people can find show notes more at actionanarchy.com/250. Check out Free Man Beyond the Wall and the Libertarian Institute. Show notes, links to all that on the show notes page, of course. And Pete, thanks again. It's been a lot of fun, and we will get into some Caffeine Turnover Drive. Maximum freedom, everyone. Peace out.
the chipmunks. C-H-I-P-M-U-N-K. We're the chipmunks. Guaranteed to brighten your day. Do, 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 do